lights on the street lights. We cultivate the culture, bring forth your contribution. City unite, rhymes, poetry, knowledge, wisdom, understanding and being stupid. City unite, put in work, network, F work, do something, make it happen, make it work, yo. City unite, flyers, we pay, spray paint, make your mark, don't backtrack, grab your backpack.
The one, from the Valley of the Sun, Master None.
Welcome to the InfoShop News Podcast for the month of January 2006. I'm Chuck Munson, the editor of InfoShop News, and I'll be hosting this first installment of our new podcast. This podcast is a collaboration of the InfoShop News Collective and volunteers on several continents. We are still learning how to use this technology, so expect some rough edges for the first few podcasts. This is my first effort in doing audio, other than interviews I've already recorded for InfoShop News. We also don't know how frequent this podcast will be produced. The technology I'm using today is easy to use, but with any new project, there are always details that require more time than you expect. We invite our listeners to get involved with the InfoShop News podcast. There are at least two ways you can get involved. The simplest being helping us promote the podcast and the InfoShop News website. If you have audio equipment, another way you can help us is to record interviews with people and send the audio to us. We also welcome recorded editorials. We now go to Erica for the week in news.
Hi, this is Erica reporting for InfoShop.org. What I'll be reading is an audio version of the InfoShop Newswire, located on the web at news.infoshop.org. That's without the www. We'll begin with the articles that have been featured in the past month. Then I'll be reading the titles and brief introductions of articles you can find on the website. Featured article number 1. NYC Rat. The NYC Year in Anarchy. With January 2006 almost a memory, we here at the NYC think it is important to remember the year that was. 2005 was a year that was rich in a diverse array of projects, resistance, victories, and heartache. Anarchy is alive in New York City, and remembering what went well, and frankly what didn't, is a step towards creating new, more successful projects and a means of improving those projects that already exist. 2005 started off with a bang in January, with a major anarchist mobilization against the presidential inauguration of George W. Bush in Washington, D.C., and the opening of a new anarchist base in Williamsburg at the Brooklyn Free Store. Featured article number 2. The Other Campaign, Zapatistas Seek to Unite Mexican Left, by David Van Dersen. San Cristobal, Mexico, January 1, 2006. Deep in the mountains and jungles of Chiapas, populated primarily with indigenous peasants, stirs a force which is seeking to upstage the high finance drama of the 2006 Mexican presidential election. The force grows out of rebel-occupied territory held by the EZLN, commonly known as the Zapatistas. The Zapatistas control 5 regions in Chiapas. Featured article number 3. Paramilitaries and Palm Plantations, A Murderous Combination in Colombia, by Carrie Leiderson. As George, a Colombian human rights lawyer, and Ernesto, a Colombian campesino from the Choco Department near the Panamanian border, made their way through Ernesto's small town on October 15th, they knew they were in trouble. As they passed the town's parque principal, they saw about 50 police and known paramilitary members gathered there. They had little doubt the group had assembled to meet them, since their contingent of Colombian activists and international human rights observers had been stopped and interrogated by police earlier in the day as they returned from the U.S. Embassy in Bogota. Featured article number 4. Review: The Ideas and Legacy of Voltairine de Cleer, by Anarcho. In her short life, Voltairine de Cleer distinguished herself as a leading intellectual, activist, speaker, and writer within the American and worldwide anarchist movement. Emma Goldman called her, quote, "the most gifted and brilliant anarchist woman America ever produced," end quote. Her activity and works covered many subjects, including anarchism, feminism, education, and the labor movement, but sadly, both are virtually unknown today. Only one collection of her writings has previously been published, The Selected Works of Voltairine de Cleyre, in 1914, edited by Alexander Berkman and published by Goldman's Mother Earth. Feature article number 5. When lying is outlawed, only politicians will lie. According to the Washington Post, 44% of Americans think lawmakers are more dishonest than our average Americans. I bring this up not to dwell on whether American national politics is the corrupt domain of liars and manipulators, it is, nor to gasp in the astonishment that the Post managed to frame their questions in such a way that 52% of Americans view themselves as so dishonest that politicians in Congress compare favorably. Featured article number 6. InfoShop being blocked by Norton Internet Security. One of the InfoShop collective members has brought it to my attention that InfoShop is being blocked by at least one version of the Norton Internet Security software. The software is apparently blocking access to this entire site under the category Crime. We don't know how extensive the censorship of our site by Norton is, or how long it has been going on. We are looking for a few volunteers to research the situation before we ask people to put pressure on Norton to cease the censorship of InfoShop. If you'd like to help us investigate the situation, please email me at chuck@mutualaid.org. And now for the articles you can find on the website. Article number 1. Atlanta. Morehouse College under fire. Protest plant. Atlanta. Morehouse College has come under fire for the alleged brutality against civil rights veteran Willie Ricks, and activists are planning a protest next week on the campus. Atlanta Progressive News has learned. Willie Ricks, aged 62, who also goes by Mukasa Dada, told Atlanta Progressive News in a series of interviews that he has suffered serious medical trauma from neck, back, shoulder, chest, and arm injury. Ricks is racking up significant medical bills, he says. Article number 2. Seattle. Shut down the National Socialist Movement. Celebrate diversity by shutting down Nazis. Meet at the Y intersection of 4th Avenue, State Avenue, and Martin Way at 11 a.m. Let the Nazis know they are not welcome in our town. Article number 3. What is the reality of the avian flu? By Maneka Gandhi. Money makes not just the world go around, but turns it topsy-turvy all the time. America needed a war to keep its armament companies happy, especially since the Vice President, Dick Cheney, himself had headed one of the largest government contracting companies. So they invented the bogey of Iraq. They destroyed Afghanistan before that, complaining there were not enough targets to shoot at from the air, so they bombed schools and hospitals. But the most money in the world does not come from just armament sales. It comes from creating scares of epidemics. Then the world's purses open up readily. Article number 4. Santiago, Chile. Bomb exploded against the National Intelligence Agency. A bombing against the National Intelligence Agency, ANI, occurred this Wednesday, January 18th. The attack intended to prove vulnerability in the repressive methods of the state, and by this, it directly attacked the institution. And that's all for now. Thanks for listening. All of these articles and much more can be found on www.infoshop.org.
InfoShop News interviewed John Beckin in September 2005 at the Radical Economics and the Labor Movement Conference, which was held here in Kansas City. Beckin is currently a professor at Albright College. He is the editor of Industrial Worker, which is the monthly newspaper of the IWW, and he's currently a member of the editorial collective for Anarcho-Syndicalist Review. This is part one of the interview. The rest of the interview can be heard in future podcasts, and the transcript will be available on the InfoShop News website in February.
Okay, it's September 16th, 2005. I'm talking to John Becken, a professor at Albright College and the editor of Industrial Worker. And what else?
I'm also on the editorial collective of the Anarcho-Syndicalist Review.
We're at the Radical Economics and the IWW conference.
Radical Economics and the Labor Movement.
Right.
Which is, part of the events around North America commemorating the centenary of the IWW.
We'll talk about the IWW centenary in a second. What is your role in the conference? And you presented a paper on.
Presented a paper on Kropotkin and situating the anarchist communism, which is, and there's a number of strands in anarchist theory, and Kropotkin is generally regarded as the creator of anarchist communism, and I was situating this within the broader working class movements of the late 19th century and arguing that Kropotkin, on the one hand, he was an exponent, but that this was a economic theory and that economic theories generally were emerging within the movement. They were being debated, and so there's clear evidence that Kropotkin's views, he didn't shape the movement's adoption, rather the movement was discussing the limitations of the anarchist, of the various economic theories that were out there, was confronting on the one hand various currents within anarchism, on the other hand Marxist currents, and the ideas that he put forward emerged in this process of debate and discussion. It's not that it was a leader-driven discussion. It's that the movement developed this theory, and then Kropotkin set about documenting it, gathering the evidence, making a clear and coherent presentation, but that there was this ongoing process, a grassroots kind of a process, as it were. So it's not like you have, a Marxist who hands down Holy Writ from on high and then the anarchists march in lockstep and say,
right,
we will be anarchist communists. And indeed, Kropotkin was relatively late in signing on. But so on the one hand, I'm making this argument about then a need to have a dialogue between theorists and the people. The ideas, if they're going to have any validity, need to emerge in the process of that self-critical discussion. I'm also making an argument about how Kropotkin set forth to empirically investigate what was going on. I mean, he looked at the prevailing economic arguments of his day, from radicals, from non-radicals. He went out to workplaces to scour the literature, but also looked at, went to mines, went to farms to firsthand observe what was going on, and concluded, based on this, that the vast majority of theorizing by both radicals and non-radicals had no relation whatever to what was actually happening. And he made an argument that if economics wants to be regarded as some sort of a science, it needs to empirically test its theories in the real world. And I think anybody who reads much mainstream economics today would know that they could benefit from applying this Kropotkinian insight and going and looking at the actual world impact of their ideas. And perhaps they would have different ideas, or perhaps they would simply have to acknowledge that they were anti-human, creatures sent here to destroy the basis for human life, but at least they would have confronted the material consequences of their ideas and taken it into account. And then I briefly sketched out his ideas in terms of, if all production is social, if all labor is social, what that says about the kind of society we might live in. So within the context of the conference, I was involved in helping conceptualize the conference. Fred Lee did most of the actual labor of organizing the papers, setting up the logistics. I did help with the promotion, with the outreach, that sort of stuff. But so I am technically a co-convener, but Fred Lee did most of the work, and I get to ride in his glory.
Right. What things that you heard at the conference did you take away and file away that you thought were really kind of insights? Or
there's a paper that I'm looking forward to hearing tomorrow from an academic economist who is talking about what political economists could learn from anarchism, which I haven't heard yet, but I'm looking forward to hearing that. I talked to a number of people about various projects that they're engaged in, that there might be possibilities for developing and doing some work with them. I've been taking notes of things that I need to follow up on, and I've always taken the position that writing was invented so I wouldn't have to remember things. Donahue's, this fellow who works as a labor consultant, actually I thought raised some interesting arguments. I disagree with the tenor of where he's going with it completely, but some interesting arguments in terms of just the practical bankruptcy of these strategies that the SEIU and such have been advocating. And I need to think about a little bit more what it means, because I can't imagine that they're not able to do this math themselves, and that they have to realize that it's quite impossible then for them to do what they say they intend to do within the resource space that they have. And that then raises the question of what they're actually trying to do. And I have to give some thought to that and talk to some people to that, but I think it does raise really interesting questions. I don't know that the strawberry campaign, which you use as an example, is the best one, because that was a particularly stupid AFL campaign. They had other campaigns which you could actually imagine how they might have succeeded.
The strawberry campaign, what did they do with that?
They did send some organizers in the field, it's true, but the main activity is that they sent leafleters and petitioners to grocery stores across the country asking shoppers to sign petitions asking store managers to tell the strawberry operators that they would not stop buying the strawberries if the strawberries went union.
Okay.
You can see how you could spend a lot of money doing this?
Right.
You can see how this would organize the strawberry fields? No? I can't see it either.
Right.
So it was a really dumb campaign, and they also did direct mail to people to send postcards, and they did get a number of grocery stores to go, you know, to agree that, yes, they would not stop buying the strawberries if the strawberries went union.
And this presenter was he the one who was talking about commission?
Yes.
Type ideas?
Yeah, and he you know, used that as his example of, you know, an incredibly expensive campaign that, you know, but I think it was abnormally stupid. The AFL does a lot of stupid things, but this campaign was abnormally stupid, even though it was the combined stupidity of two unions. So it's not like one person just goes off half-cocked, you know. And they did put, he gave a figure, which between $2.5 million that they spent on the campaign, which you or not or I, before we spent $2.5 million, we might think it through a little better. Even if we had the money, we might think it through.
He was talking also about the sort of dilemma of the full-time organizer having to devote their life to the campaign, having to move around, and kind of being rootless, and sort of other ideas of trying to get people to sign up.
Right, because that full-time organizer becomes totally alienated. They're not part of the workforce. And to me, it's not that that's new, because we've in the IWW recognize it, but it is interesting that a person who makes his living consulting with unions, training unions, assisting them, you know, in their bargaining and such, it is interesting that a person in that particular position recognizes the need to return the carrying on of the union to the membership, the organizing of the union to the, you know, I think that
it's kind of surprising.
Yes, and I think it's really interesting, and one wonders the extent to which perhaps it might represent something. I mean, perhaps he's just an outlier who, you know, reflects on his experiences. But like one of the unions he mentioned that he's worked with, the Coalition University Employees out in UCal, that is a union that emerged from mass dissatisfaction with AFSCME, the Federation of State County Municipal Employees, which had organized UCal clericals over a 20-year campaign where they built a large dues-paying voluntary membership without recognition, without a representation statute. They organized that. They won the campaign, finally got representation rights after 10, 15 years of acting union on the job. And within 2 years, they had a smaller membership than they did before they had a contract, because AFSCME came in, negotiated a contract on a statewide basis, put in a professional structure to run that contract, to administer it, and got rid of the whole grassroots, worker-oriented, you know, campaign that had built the union. And so Q represented an effort by workers to recapture the kind of unionism that they had had.
When you think about certain things that the unions, big unions, are doing against worker efforts, like autonomous efforts that are happening right now.
There's no doubt that the labor movement as a whole is not particularly democratic. And in some ways, the unions that claim to be forward-looking are among the worst of them. So you look at this Change to Win coalition, which did have a program when they first started it, and then succumbed at the end to our dues payments to the AFL should be lower and one of us should be president, not the current guy. But Unite Here, it's a merger of two allegedly progressive unions, both of which are run by people who never worked in the industries in their lives. They were hired on as college graduates onto the organizing staff and then rose through the ranks of the staff to run the unions. Andy Stern, head of the Service Employees Union, never mopped a floor. I mean, I'm sure he mopped a floor in his house. He is divorced from his wife, so he probably has to clean his own apartment sometimes. But, you know, he never worked in the industry. He, again, was on the union staff, rose to the ranks to become head of the union. And there was some talk in there about this great victory that the janitors won in L.A., and in some ways they did. I mean, there was real mobilization. A lot of janitors got involved. They did win some pay and benefit gains. But at the end of the day, some of those janitors decided they'd like to run their union local, and they ran an insurgent slate to contest the elections, and Andy Stern threw that local into receivership, throughout all the elected officers, put in his own handpicked people who were not even members of the local. He shipped them in from outside. And now he would tell you they're elected leaders because they ran an election under the international control, but they're outsiders who were opposed. There's no democracy in those unions. The unions that stayed in the AFL would claim that they're more democratic, but, and some of them are. You don't want to say that every union is in the same league, but even, you know, what does it mean? So like communication workers, they've been saying you need to have your organizers come from the ranks of the workers. And that's good. It's not good enough, but it's good. But there's still, it's still a fairly top-down structure. It's a little more connected at the lower levels with people going up and down within it. But the top level, they've been officers for decades. They're not going back to the workplace anytime soon. And indeed, if one of them wasn't reelected, which is a very difficult thing to imagine, what happens with officials in those unions who aren't reelected is they become either labor management consultants or, you know, that sort of thing. They do not go back to work in the job. It doesn't happen.
Well, speaking of the AFL-CIO split, do you see any positive things in the overall picture for American workers and global workers in what happened there?
And I think the question has to be, how do workers respond to this? I don't think there's any principled basis for the split. I would like to believe that it was going to reduce funding to the Democrats, but there's no evidence for that. SEIU alone put in tens of millions of dollars to the Democrats, even though now they say we need to focus on organizing, not politicians. But, you know, we have to look at their actions. And when you sink as much money as they did into Kerry, you know, that must mean something, right?
Right.
Because they didn't have to give that money to Kerry. You know, Kerry could have turned to his wife if he needed the money. You know, she has some. You know, he wasn't born poor himself. You know, there were resources available to them. But so in that sense, I think it would be a mistake to look to the leaders. At the same time, perhaps, I mean, there are a number of independent unions out there. Perhaps this might force unions to think somewhat more broadly about what constitutes a union, because they don't want to have a war between the former AFL unions and the current AFL, you know. So perhaps they might be more open-minded in supporting each other's struggles. That's possible. Perhaps, I haven't seen a lot of evidence of it, but as they try and justify why it is they formed a new organization, they're going to have to, you know, articulate rationale, which they've done some of before at the leadership. I haven't seen it percolate to the rank and file so much. But perhaps you might see some discussions take off amidst the rank and file, where they might start taking some of the rhetoric about organizing, about empowering workers, such forth, seriously. I mean, that would be interesting if it happened. There might be social spaces that it opens up. It could also unleash vicious raiding. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, I could be wrong. There have been some feints in that direction, but I think, frankly, the unions can't afford, their treasures aren't big enough to get involved in that, and that they'll avoid it. I hope I'm right about that.
Last spring here at UMKC, they had the this conference called the Future of American Labor. So there's a lot of local rank and file union members, and a lot of them were disgruntled with the situation of the big unions. And one of the things they talked about was the road not taken, looking back at 50 years of AFL-CIO being the problem, and the road less taken being the IWW. And now IWW has been celebrating its history this year. So if you could tell us a few things about what's been going on and the situation IWW.
In the centenary, obviously you're 100 years old, you have to throw a party, right?
Right.
And so we've been doing a number of things around, mostly around U.S. and Canada, but there have been some events in England and Australia as well. And at the end of October, our general secretary is going to go to Germany and Switzerland for a speaking tour. She was invited to come and speak on the IWW there, so we will do that. They're paying her way. So we had a big conference in Chicago on the weekend over, I mean, the original founding convention lasted 8, 9, 10 days, and we didn't want to spend 10 days. We can't. Back then, perhaps workers had longer vacations than they do today. But we did do a conference that started on Thursday night with a Utah Phil's John McCutcheon concert. Then we had a variety of programs through the Sunday, including a conference that drew between 300 and 400 people. Over the course of the conference, certainly 400 people, but at any given moment, they're. And the first day was largely historical. The second day was largely looking at current campaigns, both IWW campaigns and independent labor campaigns, to talk about ways that we can draw on the heritage, yes, the ideas, yes, but move forward. Because like when we published our official history, the first one, it was the IWW's first 50 years. We have a new edition coming out, its first 100 years. But it's not, the first is meant to indicate that we're not done, right?
Well,
so long as there is this system of exploitation around us, the work of the union does continue. And so we did that conference. There was a conference out in Vancouver that had a number of IWW-themed sessions. There's an art show traveling the country that we didn't organize but is about the IWW. There's a show of reproductions from the archives of the IWW at Wayne State University that's been exhibited in Winnipeg, in Philadelphia, in Chicago. It's been traveling, as well. There have been a number of regional conferences, various, concerts, art shows, readings. The New York branch put on a dramatic performance, a dramatic reading of exits. We had a stenographer at their founding convention, so we had very detailed notes of what was said.
Oh, wow.
So they had people, read, perform.
Interesting.
Now, they didn't spend 10 days doing it. They did it in one day. So, it's the highlights, but.
That's the hell of a year of a party.
Yes, yes. And, we're not done. I think we still have a new edition of the songbook to come out. Later this month, there's going to be a talk in Philadelphia. There's this cartoon history of the IWW, frankly not very good, but that's a different question. But it's traveling around, and often we're asked to give presentations in conjunction with it. And there's going to be things continuing into early 2006, I think. Again, next month, yeah, we're still in September. Next month, there's a big conference in Detroit that's marking the centenary of the 1905 Russian Revolution and the IWW founding. Because, you know, these are two events of comparable historic importance, of course. We didn't decide this. You know, it's Wayne State University that organizes this conference. And, you know, so they are objective judges of the relative importance of events, right?
I tend to listen to Wayne State.
In terms of what the IWW is doing today, on the one hand, membership just last year, I mean, we just did our annual convention
a couple weeks ago,
and the membership statistics show that dues income, and which we didn't raise the dues, so dues income is directly related to the number of people paying dues, right? It's up 35% this year from the year before.
That's good.
So, you know, and we've had this long-term trend where for the last, you know, 5 years, membership has been higher each year than it was the year before. And if you look back a little longer, there was a little disruption 5, 6, 7 years ago. But you go back like 10 years, 15 years, membership is basically triple today what it was 10 years ago. And so there's a long-term trend, and there's no time when it was higher. It's just there was a period where it was growing, then it dropped, and then it's growing again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we have organizing going, largely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is also the question of what's happening with the economy, and that does cause some disgruntled workers to seek out alternatives. But they don't stay unless there's activity that, you know, holds them. And we have a number of campaigns. So, for example, in Northern California, we have this campaign among short-haul truckers,
right,
almost entirely immigrants. They're paid by the load. They used to be hourly employees. The bosses got it in their mind that it would be more efficient, better to deal with entrepreneurs. So they tell them, you go buy your own trucks. We're not going to hire people anymore, but we'll help you get loans. You buy your own trucks and you set yourself up as an independent businessman and we'll hire you.
It's like piecemeal trucking.
Yeah, yeah. So they have to buy their own gas, pay their own trucks, pay their own maintenance bills, their own insurance. And if the truck gets, you know, the ports get congested, they sit for 2 or 3 or 4 hours waiting to get the job, and they're not paid any extra for that. And if the fuel prices go up, they're hit with that. And if there's a slow period and the cargo's not coming in, they get hit with that cost too. All the costs are downloaded onto these truckers. Isn't it great being an independent entrepreneur? Well, they decided to organize around this, and we've had a number of strikes, and mostly in Stockton, the majority of the truckers have joined the IWW.
Right.
We have some support in, that's a railhead. We have some support in ports as well. That's a lot weaker. There's been a number of wildcat strikes. We're trying to work with people to build committees that would give some sort of ongoing character, because, you know, you can rise up for a week or two, but if you don't have ongoing organization, it's difficult to maintain whatever you win during those quick strikes, because the employers, you know, there's lots of small employers who hire the truckers, and they're each competing to get the jobs from the shippers, so there's a constant incentive to chip away. But in Stockton, we've won a promise that if the wait is longer than an hour, they will get paid an hourly rate for the time that they're waiting.
Right.
That's not something that was gladly conceded, and we keep having to fight for it, but it's holding. We have campaigns going among retail workers in a number of cities. In Philadelphia, perhaps the best organized of that. This campaign's been going on for a couple of years. We're trying to organize the entire South Street retail district, which, you know, has several thousand workers,
right,
and a couple hundred shops. I mean, it's ranges from chain outlets to little tiny boutiques that are the only, and pay ranges from not even minimum wage to $10-$11 an hour, you know, you might make if some of the more, you know, no benefits, of course. But, and so we're trying to set some area standards in that campaign, and we have a district-wide grievance committee that works with people who identify concerns. And we run a number of health clinics because no one has health care, so we brought in various agencies. We ran a tax clinic back in early April to help workers claim earned income credits and, you know, to make sure that they got back as much as they could of what the IRS had taken from them, because, you know, they need that money. You know, they need it much more than the bomb makers do. And, you know, we've had a number of projects of that sort to, on the one hand, provide immediate benefits to workers in the district. On the other hand, to help them confront conditions on the job, we built job committees in a number of shops, carried out direct actions where people were being threatened with losing their jobs. In several cases, one. Other cases we've lost, one guy, one of our organizers at Whole Foods got fired about a month ago for taking a snack on some discarded sushi. But we did win his unemployment hearing. Management fought his unemployment. They got an unemployment referee to rule that he shouldn't be compensated. Well, we went and we appealed that, and he just got his ruling that indeed he is entitled to his unemployment. Now, it's not the greatest victory. A greater victory would be that he got his job back, but we live in a pretty precarious, industrial system where it's not easy to do that. We've gotten some people their jobs back, but it's a lot. That's hard. We have a whole range of those. There's a half dozen cities where we have campaigns like that going. We've got a campaign going in the San Francisco Bay Area among recycling workers. We do represent two shops under contract there, one that picks up the stuff, one that sorts the stuff. We've got a campaign among restaurant workers up in Oregon. We've got a campaign up in Oregon among computer software workers, which has had some success primarily in sort of raising awareness of the protections that people have, but has been chasing a particular employer who cheated at least a couple dozen workers. He hired them to do software development in this outsourced kind of an environment where they didn't come in and work and meet each other. He would give them a piece of the code and they would write it. Well, one of the people he cheated this way was a wobbly. A very bad choice, because this wobbly then decided he wanted to get his wages. Wobblies are like that. They work, they expect to be paid. And in the process of this, he started reaching out, and we've identified many workers who were robbed of their wages, and we've chased this guy from several different office complexes. We show up. We've collected several thousand dollars from him, too, but he still owes a lot more. You'll show up, and he'll give you $2,000 or $3,000 to get you to go away, and he'll promise he'll give you the rest tomorrow. You go back tomorrow. He shut down that office and set up somewhere else. But we've been chasing him, and we're going to keep chasing him. And he's put up a website that says the IWW are the people who assassinated William McKinley. We weren't founded then, but he's clearly been driven to distraction by this campaign. Now, he could just settle up and pay his workers, but apparently he can't. Whether for moral reasons or perhaps he manages his industry so badly that he can't. And we have a big campaign also in Chicago among messengers, where we've had a number of job actions. People have turned off their dispatch radios for a couple of hours. We've won several wage hikes and such. So we have a lot of different campaigns going on, some in more stable workplaces, some in these really transitory kinds of work situations.
InfoShop News can be found on the internet at news.infoshop.org. We bring you a variety of independent and mainstream news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can reach us by sending an email to chuck@mutualaid.org or by visiting the website and clicking on the Contact Us link at the top of any page. We'd like to thank a few people for making this podcast possible. Erica for reading the news. William Thakey for helping get the project started, The Drunken Immortals for the music at the top of the show, and Strike Anywhere for the music you're about to hear. We thank you for listening.
When they broke down the door with the guns in the face of your wife and child, and as they pinned you to the floor, did you say, "Officer, I'm not resisting you"? American justice, American dream, it's just what.